Shalom Harav Arnix. Welcome to our next class in the School of Biblical and Jewish Studies by Hadavar Messianic Ministries. Our next class is the First Regathering, Zionism, and the Modern State of Israel. This is session one, which is our part of our introductory session, our introductory material. And I have provided class material for you. You do have class material available if you'd like to download it from the internet. Here is the address, http://www.hadavar.org/SBJS, that stands for School of Biblical and Jewish Studies, /online-classes/the-first-regathering, and it's -2019. So this is the address you need to put into your browser. And if you go to that address, this is the page you will be brought to. It is the page on the First Regathering in the Modern State of Israel. What I'd like you to do when you get to this page is to just scroll down the page, and just a short distance down the page, you'll come across a bunch of PDF files, and these PDF files are your class material, your outline, and some additional materials, handouts, and all that, that will help you as you go through this study. So feel free to, again, go to this particular address, and it'll take you right to the correct page. Now, I want to start by explaining the philosophy behind your outline, your class material. I've given you detailed outlines for two reasons. Reason number one, so you won't be distracted by note-taking. Now, I know a number of you like to take notes, and that's fine. Go right ahead and do so. But if you're like me, you get distracted when you have to take notes. So I want you to concentrate on all that I'm teaching you so that you can absorb it all. If you take notes, you'll be shifting your attention back and forth from the lecture to the page and then back again. In other words, you'll easily miss some of the material. If you can focus on what I'm saying, you won't miss any of it. You'll understand it in better, more depth. Okay, that's the first reason why I've given you detailed notes that you can download from this address. Secondly, I've given you detailed notes so that you'll have the material for reference later on, so you can review the lecture, review the material later on in your life. Then, when your Jewish friend comes over to visit and you start talking about Israel, you'll be able to pull out your outline and review your outline with your friend. Then you can also use your outline to defend Israel and the Jewish people from propaganda and misunderstanding with the facts. And then the facts, of course, are found in your outline. And then you could use that outline to teach a class, maybe a Sunday school class, maybe a home group, something like that. But you can spread this material around even further by using that material. So please, don't feel you have to take notes. 95% of the material is going to be there in front of you if you download the PDFs. So you may have to jot down a note or two, but you'll already have it there. So just please try to focus on the lecture. All right, at this point, I'd like to just review the table of contents for this class. This, again, is part of your material. We'll start with a bibliography on page 3. I put that in the front so that you'll be able to more easily get to the material, to the resources that I've used. And then I highlight the Jewish Virtual Library on page 5 because that is such a good source for material about Israel. But we'll get into the heart of the lecture in section one, I should say. There'll be four sections to this class. Section one is the spiritual war. And so we'll talk about what is Zion, what is Zionism. We'll talk about biblical support for Zionism, the prophetic significance of Zionism. We'll look at the principle of expansion and contraction that Israel lives under. We'll take a look at the chronological sequence of events. We'll talk a little bit about Islam, and I'll share a few rabbinic thoughts about the modern state and Zionism with you. Then we'll get into section two, which is the background. This is an historical survey of the period from 66 AD to 1839 AD. Section three, I entitled End of Exile from 1839 to 1947. This details the modern Zionist movement. And then finally, Section 4, The Unending War, 1948 to the Present, dealing with the modern state of Israel. So that's where we're going in this particular lecture. Now, you should be on page 7 of your outline now if you've downloaded the PDF. Now, let me state right from the start that very little information that teachers share with their students consists of original material. Most teachers are passing on to others what they have received from their classes, from the classes they've attended, and from what they've learned researching the works of others. And that principle applies significantly to this class as well. This class will not be particularly original. For the most part, I'll be quoting or paraphrasing the thoughts of other authors. And you can see the sources of most of my information in the bibliography on pages 3 and 4. Now, before I get into the material directly, I want to highlight for you two of the major sources of my class. Number one is A History of Israel, Volume 1, from 1807 to 1975 by Howard M. Sachar, published by Alfred Knopf. That's the key book there. And then the second key reference material is A History of Israel, Volume 2, 1975 to 1982 by Howard M. Sachar, this time published by Oxford University Press. The vast majority of the comments that I make during this class will come out of these two books. A History of Israel was considered the most complete and authoritative book on the subject. Now, of course, Sachar's book will cover much more material and have much more depth than I'll be able to present to you. I'll only have time to share with you excerpts from the book. So if you wish to study the subject in greater detail, that is the book. That's the book that I would highly recommend you purchase. So I am indebted to Howard Sachar's fine work. Most of the statements I make are simply excerpts or paraphrases of his exceptional scholarship. So without his detailed and articulate work, this class would not be possible. Now, in this outline, I've footnoted the more important quotes found in A History of Israel so that the student can locate them easily in Sachar's work. Now, another key work, although more limited in scope, is Arthur Kack's work, The Death and Resurrection of Israel. I hope it's still in print. I'm not sure if it is or not, published by King Brothers. I will quote from this work, but again, it might be out of print. Another very helpful work is Martin Gilbert's Atlas of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. This is the 6th edition, from 1000 BC to 1993 AD, published by Oxford University Press. This book covers in map form the complete history of the struggle and the efforts made to resolve it. So I highly recommend that you purchase this book as well, especially if there's an updated version out there, something a little newer. Now, on the internet, a good resource is the Jewish Virtual Library. Here is the address of the Jewish Virtual Library, and we're looking at the table of contents. So if you go to this website, go to the Israel section, click on the section on Israel in the table of contents. That will take you to the Israel wing of the library, and you'll see a number of topics arranged there alphabetically. So Zionism is at the very end of the list, of course, being a Z. So go to Zion, click on Zionism, and that will take you to the Zionism area of the Israel wing. And you'll see there's a multitude of articles there, a tremendous amount of information about Zionism that you can look at yourself in greater detail. Now, if you go to Wikipedia, and you can go to Wikipedia, but if you do, be very discerning regarding the articles that you read. Some of them are very, very good, but others are definitely tainted with Arab propaganda against Israel. So be a little careful if you go to Wikipedia for information about Israel. So additional resources, all of these are listed in your bibliography on pages 3 and 4. A great book to read is O Jerusalem by Collins and LaPierre, published by Simon & Schuster. Gives the history of the struggle over the city of Jerusalem. Our Man in Damascus, Ailey Cohn. This is by Ailey Ben-Hanan by Steinmetzky. It is the story of Israel's probably most successful spy. You can see he was eventually caught, but he did a tremendous amount of good for the country as a spy. The Complete Idiot's Guide to the Middle East Conflict by Mitchell Bard, by Alpha Books, a very good resource to have. Myths and Facts, A Guide to the Arab-Israeli Conflict, again by Mitchell Bard, published by AICE. Very, very helpful bit of material. The book From Time Immemorial by Joan Peters, published by JKAP. Now, this is a classic work that you should own. Joan Peters started out to write this book from the Palestinian point of view. But then as the truth of the facts of what was going on in the Middle East came before her as she researched all this, she switched over to the Israeli perspective. And she saw that the Palestinians have not been living in the land from time immemorial. That was their claim. They came into the land because the Jewish people provided economic incentives, provided economic opportunity. So again, From Time Immemorial by Joan Peters, the Palestinians hate this book because it totally invalidates their narrative. One of my tour guides, Hila Crown Tamir, has written a short book, Israel, History in a Nutshell. It is a short book about Israel's history, but well worth picking up. This Atlas by Martin Gilbert, published by Dorset Press, An Atlas of Jewish History, is a good resource to have in your library. It is not limited to the history of Israel. It covers the history of the Jewish people in map form. So again, a very good book to have. Michael Rydelnik of Moody Bible Institute has written this book, Understanding the Arab-Israeli Conflict, published by Moody Press. Again, a valuable addition to your library. The Rebirth of the State of Israel, Arthur W. Kak, published by Baker Bookhouse. Another worthwhile addition to your library. And from Ariel Ministries, Dr. Fruchtenbaum has produced a historical and geographical study guide of Israel. Again, a very worthwhile resource. And also his historical and geographical maps of Israel, covering the history of the nation in maps by Ariel Ministries. Now, there are video resources that are fine to pick up as well. We'll be looking at some of them, or I'll be asking you to look at some of them. This one in particular, Against All Odds, Israel Survives by Questar. Also, Israel, A Nation is Born. This is Abba Iban's classic work, published by Jeremiah Films. And then Israel, The Birth of a Nation by the History Channel. Again, all worthwhile additions to your library. So at this point, we're on page 8 of your handouts, your table of your outline, and let's just review section 1, the spiritual war. Let's take a look at that in more detail. This is where we'll be going in just a few minutes. So in the spiritual war, we'll talk about the question, what is Zion? What is Zionism? Then we'll give biblical support for Zionism. We'll look at Psalm 137, verses 1 through 6. Genesis 12, verses 1 through 3 in the Abrahamic Covenant. Genesis 12, 7. Genesis 13. Genesis 15. We'll look at Deuteronomy 28, 64 through 30, 10, which deals with the land covenant. Psalm 105. We'll talk about the duration of the title deed as developed by Jeremiah. And we'll look at the prophetic significance of the state of Israel, the pattern of dispersion and regathering, the Russian invasion of Israel to come, the fact that this is the first regathering, and we'll note the characteristics of the first regathering and note and compare them with the second regathering. We'll talk about the blessings of the Mosaic Covenant, the curses of the Mosaic Covenant, and the times of the Gentiles. So that is where we're going in the next few minutes. All right, right at this point, however, what I'd like you to do is to play section 1, program number 1, from Against All Odds, Israel Survives. Program number 1 is called The Assignment, and it's a 26-minute segment out of this video. And you can find this video on Amazon.com. Here's the address. You can just go to Amazon and put in Against All Odds, Israel Survives, and I'm sure it'll pop up for you. But this is the address if you want to pause your YouTube and copy it down. So you can get it on Amazon. You can also view it on YouTube. I'm sure if you put in the name, it would easily pop up for you. But here is the address as well on YouTube. If that's your choice, just stop your computer at this point. Pause the YouTube video at this point and copy down this address. So I would like, again, I'd like to repeat that. I'd like you to view the first 26 minutes of Against All Odds as an introduction to this program. All right. For those of you who have now watched the 26 minutes, or perhaps if you haven't, at the end of that session, you will see that Michael Greenspan, the host, asks a number of questions. He'll pose a number of questions for us. For example, how have the Jewish people managed to survive 2,000 years of exile? Good question. Number two, how did we manage to build a nation out of almost nothing? Number three, how did Israel manage to win the 1948 war? Number four, in 1973, why would President Nixon, who was considered by many to be devoutly anti-Semitic, order the biggest arms airlift since World War II and save Israel? Number five, why were no Israelis killed by Saddam Hussein's Scud missiles during the Gulf War? Six, why are the outcomes of Israel's wars so unique? Seven, how did Hebrew become the only dead language in history to become revived? Eight, after 2,000 years, why would millions of people from around the world leave their homes and move to a desert wasteland and build new lives for themselves? That's a great question, isn't it? Nine, how did these people turn a land that's more than 80% desert into one of the largest food and flour exporters in the world? Number 10, why do incredible achievements in science, medicine, and new technologies happen here in greater concentration than anywhere else? And finally, question 11, how did this tiny nation, surrounded by implacable enemies with limited natural resources, manage to become the 10th most powerful nation in the world in only 66 years? Now, that shows you that the video is a little dated because Israel is now 72 years old. So just change that from 66 to 72, and it's the same question. So you will know the answer to all of those questions by the time this course is finished. All right, we're at page 9 in the top now, top of your page, page 9 of your outline. And the material that I'm about to cover can also be found in my book, Biblical Perspectives on the Middle East, and is available through Amazon.com if you want to pick that up. So let's begin with the question, what is Zion? Zion, Zion. The meaning is unknown. We don't know what it means. Perhaps fortress. That's probably the best guess that it means fortress. Now, originally, Zion was the fortified mound between the Kidron and Tyropian valleys. Here is the southeastern hill. And on one side, the eastern side, is the Kidron Valley coming down the eastern side of that hill, southeastern hill, and then the Tyropian Valley coming down the western side of the southeastern hill. It was the name of the Jebusite stronghold. And again, the southeastern hill of Jerusalem on which that stronghold stood. Here again is the Tyropian Valley coming up the west side of the hill, and the Kidron Valley coming up the east side. And between the two is Mount Zion, between the two right there. Now, there's another very, very important valley that we should note surrounding Jerusalem, and this is the Kidron Valley, a Valley of Hinnom. The Valley of Hinnom curves around the south and western side of the city. Now, people have noticed that the three valleys bisecting Jerusalem, or bisecting, surrounding Jerusalem and merging and moving through it, remind one of the letter Sheen, the Hebrew letter Sheen. And here's a look at a Hebrew letter Sheen. You can see the Valley of Hinnom on the west and bottom side, portrayed by the left-hand stroke. Then the Tyropian Valley going through the middle of the city, portrayed by the middle stroke. And the Kidron Valley on the east side of the city, portrayed by the right-hand stroke. Now, why is this important? Why is this significant to many people? Well, this is significant because the letter Sheen is a symbol of God, symbol of God. It is the first letter of the word Shaddai in God Almighty, El Shaddai. And so Sheen is a Jewish symbol of God. You see it showing up all over the place. For example, here is a mezuzah, and there's the Sheen of Shaddai at the top of the mezuzah. Beneath that mezuzah is the small parchment that's rolled up and placed in it. in obedience to the command found in Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 9. Here is the origin of the mezuzah. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk of them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. That's the command. Put the word of the Lord on the door frames of your houses and on your city gates. And so the Jewish community takes this very, very seriously, literally. And so here's a man, an Orthodox man in Israel, attaching a mezuzah to his door frame, to his new home. And of course, inside that mezuzah is the parchment containing the command. And so we have the three valleys that are so important to the city of Jerusalem. Here's a top view again of the city. This is the Hinnom Valley on the west and south, and then the Tyropian Valley going through the middle of the city here, and the third stroke, the Kidron Valley on the east side of the city. One, two, three. Three valleys, and Mount Zion between valley number two and valley number three, the Tyropian and Kidron Valleys. Now here's a three-quarter view. This is kind of a nice drawing. We have the Kidron Valley here to the east, and then the Central Valley or the Tyropian Valley to the west, and in between the two is Mount Zion. Mount Zion, where David's city and David's palace were located. To the north of Mount Zion is Mount Moriah. This would be where the temple, this is where the temple would be constructed by his son Solomon, Mount Moriah, to the north of the city of David. And this is the way the city looks today. This is the way the valleys look today. Here is the Kidron Valley on the east side of the southeastern hill. And this is the southeastern hill itself, Mount Zion, biblical Mount Zion. You cannot see the Tyropian Valley today because it is filled in with rubble. There is a small section of the Tyropian Valley that you can visit, a very tiny section, and that is the Southern Temple Mount Archaeological Gardens. Now, the first time I was ever in Israel, this was the ground level. This red dotted line was the ground level. And since then, the archaeologists have excavated at least 40 feet of rubble and removed it and brought, and so now tourists can go down to the Herodian street level, the Herodian street level where Jesus walked. And you can bet your retirement Jesus walked upon these streets. However, that even that Herodian level, I believe, is 40 feet above the bottom of the Tyropian Valley. So there's still a lot of rubble beneath this street. But at least you get a sense of the Tyropian Valley there at the Southern Temple Mount Archaeological Garden. So what is Zion? Zion started out as the southeastern hill. Later, the name was progressively expanded to include the Temple Mount, and eventually all of Jerusalem came under the name Zion. It became to be applied figuratively to all of Judah and eventually to the Jewish people as a whole. And through this process of change, the name developed a religious connotation, emphasizing Jerusalem as the city of God and the Israelites as God's people. Now, there are at least 163 verses in the scriptures that refer to Zion. Let me share just three of them with you. First of all, 2 Samuel 5, 7. Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. And we've seen that on the map. Then Isaiah says in Isaiah 60, verse 14, the sons of those who afflicted you will come bowing to you, and all those who despised you will bow themselves at the soles of your feet, and they will call you the city of the Lord, the Zion, the fortress of the Holy One of Israel. And then, of course, in the New Testament, the Brit HaDashah, Hebrews 12:22, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels. So again, Mount Zion is named throughout Scripture. Now, biblical Mount Zion should never be confused with modern Mount Zion. There is a difference between biblical Mount Zion and modern Mount Zion. Now, we're in, let's take a look at this. Here is our map again, and here is the Tyropian Valley. Now, biblical Mount Zion is to the east of the Tyropian Valley, But modern Mount Zion is to the west of the Tyropian Valley. This is the area called Mount Zion today. It is not biblical Mount Zion. It was called the Upper City in earlier centuries. Again, here is the Tyropian Valley or the Central Valley running to the west of biblical Mount Zion, but then running to the, and there's the Upper City, modern Mount Zion, and you can see, you can spot modern Mount Zion easily today by looking for this church with the conical roof. I believe that's a Lutheran church, but it sits atop modern Mount Zion. Again, this is not biblical Mount Zion. All right. Now we're on page 9, about the middle of the page of your notes, and we've asked the question, what is Zion? We've looked at that particular question. But now we're going to ask the question, what is Zionism? Let me back up here. I'm sorry. There's modern Mount Zion. Yes, we're going to ask the question now, what is Zionism? And there are many opinions and definitions of Zionism. So we're going to go to the website, Jews, Not Zionists. And this will give you a negative view of Zionism. Here, these rabbis say that Judaism is opposed to Zionism. And why do they say that? Well, here's some reasons. Let me share these reasons with you. Rabbi S.R. Hirsch says, "The Torah forbids us to strive for the reunion or possession of the land by any but spiritual means." So he does not feel that modern Israel has been, the land has been repossessed by spiritual means. Then Rabbi S.D. Schneerson says, "Not via our desire did we leave the land of Israel, and not via our power will we come back to the land of Israel." So he doesn't feel that the reinstitution of the state of Israel is of God. It's a human event. Then Rabbi C. Soloveitchik says, "Zionists want a state in order to make Jews into heretics." Well, that's a pretty clear negative view of Zionism. And then Rabbi V. Soloveitchik says, "The Zionists have attacked the center point of Judaism." So for these rabbis, Zionism is unspiritual, it's arrogant, it is a heresy, and they want nothing to do with it. All right, now we're on page 10 of your outline. Now, the source of my comments, next comments, is the Jewish Virtual Library. And I'm going to talk with you about how the United Nations defines Zionism. Here's the United Nations headquarters in New York City. And let's take a look at United Nations General Assembly Resolution 3379. It was instituted November 10th, 1975, repealed in 1991, but I'm afraid the sentiment behind this resolution has never been repealed in many of the country's minds. So how do they define Zionism? Well, they say, "The General Assembly, recalling its resolution 1904, blah, 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 recalling also that in its resolution 3151G, yak, 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 taking note of the Declaration of Mexico, blah, 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 blah. Taking note also of Resolution 77, now turn to page 11. Taking note also of the political declaration." Now they're going to finally come to a declaration of what Zionism is after all this long, verbose statements. They finally determine, after all that, that Zionism is a form of racism and racial discrimination. So that's the UN's view of Zionism. And like I said, probably still the view of many, many countries that are part of the United Nations. All right. Well, you know, there's Christian anti-Semites out there. And one of those Christian anti-Semites is Stan Rittenhouse. And Stan Rittenhouse has written a book called For Fear of the Jews. And in this book, you will read this, page 7, he says, "During this period between the first and second coming of Jesus Christ, a satanic counterfeit, political Zionism, masquerading as the state of Israel, will be established." So for him, Zionism is a satanic counterfeit. Now, what about the Palestinians, what do they think about Zionism? Well, here's a look at the Palestinian Charter, section number 22. They define Zionism this way. Zionism is a political movement organically associated with international imperialism and antagonistic to all action for liberation and to progressive movements in the world. It is racist and fanatic in its nature, aggressive, expansionist, and colonial in its aims, fascist in its methods. So, those are some pretty negative views of Zionism. Heresy, racism, racial discrimination, a satanic counterfeit, a political movement that is aggressive, expansionist, colonialist, and fascist. That's what most people think of Zionism. But what's the true definition of Zionism? What is the biblical definition of Zionism? Well, let me share with you Dr. Fruchtenbaum's contribution to the question. He says, the definition of Zionism. The word Zionism describes a feeling. Zionism is an expression of the longing and yearning that the Jewish people have had in the past and still have for their homeland. As soon as any Jew expressed a desire to go back to his land, he is expressing Zionism. Again, Dr. Fruchtenbaum. All right, we'll see that this definition is accurate when we get to the section Biblical Support for Zionism in just a moment. On page 12 of your outline, however, there's an article by Dr. Michael Rydelnik, Zion, a Profound Biblical Word. I'd like you to read that article over as your homework so you get another positive view of Zionism, a biblical view of Zion and Zionism. All right, we're now on page 13 of your outline, and we're going to start the section Biblical Support for Zionism. Remember, Zionism is the longing of the Jewish people for their home. That is the proper, correct, and biblical definition of Zionism. And this is supported by a number of sections of Scripture, for example, Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows, in the midst of it, we hung our harps. For there our captors demanded of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. So Psalm 137 expresses the emotional longing of the Jewish person contained in the word Zion and Zionism. But Zionism is not merely a subjective emotion. It's not simply a subjective emotion. Zionism is likewise supported by two of the covenants that God has made with the Jewish people. Now, some suggested reading for further study before we get into this from the Messianic Bible Study Collection by Dr. Fruchtenbaum, number 21, manuscript, Messianic Bible Study number 21, the Eight Covenants of the Bible. So that's some suggested resources for you. Also, you'll find that material in my book, Biblical Perspectives on the Middle East. So again, resources for further study about this, about Zionism and the biblical support for Zionism. Okay, the first covenant that supports Zionism is the Abrahamic Covenant. And this chart is on page 14, I believe, in your notes. The Abrahamic Covenant was instituted with Abraham in Genesis 12, 13, 15, and 17. It was then confirmed through Isaac, not Abraham's other son Ishmael, in Genesis 26. It was then confirmed through Isaac, not Isaac's other son Esau, to Jacob in Genesis 28. And then it was confirmed to all 12 of Jacob's tribes, sons, in Genesis 49. Now, the Abrahamic covenant is also the biblical definition of who is a Jew. A Jew is the descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It is a family relationship, and this is brought out very clearly in Amos 3:2. There, Amos, or God says, through Amos, you only have I chosen among all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities. It's not always fun to be Jewish, is it? But the Jewish people are called a family, one of many families of the earth. So it is a family relationship, a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, the Abrahamic covenant is made up of three basic promises: a land promise, a nation promise, also sometimes called a seed promise, and a spiritual blessing promise. Now, the Abrahamic covenant is found in several segments of Genesis. And the first segment is found in the 12th chapter of Genesis in the first three verses. So let's take a look at verse 1. We'll start in verse 1 here. Now the Lord said to Abram, "Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to a land which I will show you." So three promises make up this unconditional and eternal covenant. Three are stated. Number one, God is going to show Abraham a land. And that promise is twofold. Not only will Abraham be given a land, but the land will be given to Abraham's descendants as well. The land promises to you and your descendants. And we see this in verse 7. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. Now the second segment of the Abrahamic covenant comes after Abraham enters the land that God promised to show him. And God proceeds to tell Abraham that Abraham's descendants, his seed, will be given the land. Nothing more than that is said as far as the land aspect is concerned. However, there's been an increase in data in verse 7 there. We move from merely being shown the land in verse 1 to the promise that the land will be given to his descendants in verse 7. Now, the third segment of the covenant is found in Genesis 13, verses 14 through 17. Now, you're probably at the bottom of the page of page 13 right now. So let's take a look at Genesis 13, 14 through 17, the third segment. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, "Now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which you see I will give to you and your descendants forever. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you." So two main points come out of this passage. First of all, there's a further elaboration on the land aspect. So concerning the land, God says, "To you I will give this land." Not only Abraham's descendants were promised the land, but Abraham himself is promised the land. And for that reason, he's ordered to inspect the land. God says, "Go walk through the land, the length and breadth of the land. I am giving it to you." All right, so that's the land promise. Then we come to the nation promise. Again, it's twofold. Your family will be the chosen family, and your family will have a unique relationship with the Gentile nations. This is in verse 2, "And I will make you a great nation." There is the nation promise, of the Abrahamic covenant, the seed aspect or the national aspect of the promise. Some commentators call it the seed promise or the seed aspect. So again, a nation will come forth from Abraham that will eventually become numerous. And again, the promise is twofold. A second provision covers the relationship the Gentiles will experience with the people who come from Abraham. Those who bless Abraham and his seed will be blessed. Those that curse will be cursed. And this is in Genesis 12:3. "I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse." And this is not said of any other nation in the world. It's not said of America. It's not said of England. It's not said of Russia or India or Afghanistan or Persia or Monaco. It doesn't matter. It's not said about any other nation in the world except Israel. "I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse." There's a unique relationship the Jewish people will have with the Gentile nations. That's the national promise, national election, and a unique relationship with the Gentile nations, a twofold promise. The third provision concerns the spiritual benefits of the covenant. Ultimately, it is in Abraham that the Gentiles will receive their spiritual blessings. And again, this promise is twofold. So we have our national promise and now the spiritual blessing promise. God will bless Abraham, and Abraham will bless the world. And this is in verse 3, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. Now, another factor relating to the Abrahamic covenant is that it is an eternal covenant. All right. We'll work through this chart. You have it on page 17. We learn that the Abrahamic covenant is also an eternal covenant. In a number of verses, we'll just look at Genesis 17:7. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout your generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. So the covenant is eternal in nature, but the covenant is also unconditional in nature. And this is seen in Genesis 15. And so we'll start with verses 1 through 6 of Genesis 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Avram in a vision, saying, Do not fear, Avram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great. And Avram said, O Lord God, what will you give me, since I am childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus? And Avram said, Since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir. And then, behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, This man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. And he took him outside and said, Now look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you're able to count them. He said to him, So shall your descendants be. And then he, that's Avram, believed the Lord, and he, the Lord, reckoned it to Avram as righteousness. And here's a nice illustration of Abraham looking to the sky, looking and seeing the innumerable stars, as God promised that his descendants would be as plentiful as the stars in the sky. All right, the fourth segment of the Abrahamic covenant is here in chapter 15, and the entire chapter is devoted to this theme. Now, in verses 1 through 6, we've seen an elaboration of the seed aspect. Again, Abraham is assured, and it's been a number of years since the initial promise of the seed had been given back in chapter 12. Abraham is assured that nevertheless he will have a son through Sarah, through whom the nation and the people will come. And then in verses 7 through 21, God will deal with the land aspect. Now, in this segment, God states the actual northern and southern boundaries of the land. And in chapter 15, we will also observe the sealing of the covenant. Now, the normal pattern by which covenants were sealed or signed back then followed this ritual, this procedure. The two parties making the covenant would take a number of animals, they would slaughter them, they would cut them in half, and they would line up the carcasses in two rows. Then the two people who were making the covenant would walk between the pieces of the animals. Basically, they'd be saying, May what happened to these animals happen to me if I break this covenant. So this is a kind of a self-curse to ensure the fact that they are sincere about this covenant. And we can see this in very clearly in view in Jeremiah 34:18. In Jeremiah 34:18 we read, The men who have violated my covenant and have not fulfilled the terms of the covenant they have made before me, I will treat like the calf they cut in two and then walk between the pieces. So there's the idea. They've broken the covenant. They will be treated as covenant breakers, which is pretty serious. So having walked through the pieces, the covenant or the treaty is now binding on both individuals. Both are obligated to keep it. If one is guilty of breaking the covenant, that releases the other party from having to fulfill his part in the covenant. Now, there are certain things that are the same and certain things that are different as this covenant with Abraham is sealed. Let's start with Genesis 7. Pick it up on Genesis 7, where Abraham sets up the covenant ritual. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of the Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. He said, O Lord, how may I know that I will possess it? And he said to him, Bring me a three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old female goat, a three-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. Here Abraham is the answer. I'm going to assure you that I will keep my covenant. And he brought all these to him and cut them in two and laid each half opposite the other, and he did not cut the birds. And the birds of prey came down on the carcasses, and Avram drove them away. So Avraham has set up the covenant ritual. He wants to know, he wants to be assured that he will receive God's promise, and God is going to tell him in no uncertain terms, Abraham, I will never break my covenant. So the covenant ritual is set up, and Abraham there is driving the birds away, the birds of prey. Now the Bible Knowledge Commentary has a nice comment to say about Avram driving the birds away. They say, God's announcement of Israel's enslavement in verses 13 and 14 clarified the meaning of the attacking birds. Egypt, like birds of prey, opposed the covenant, but ultimately the covenant will be fulfilled, no matter what. Egypt, no country, nobody can stop the fulfillment of this covenant. And so Abraham is protecting the covenant, and it is God who will see that it gets fulfilled, no matter what. No enemy, no country, nobody can stop the fulfillment of this covenant. So we come, the signing and sealing of the covenant comes in verses 12 through 16. So let's move ahead to the next few verses. Now, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Avram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. So he's asleep. He's not moving. He's somewhere off to the side in this deep, kind of trance-like sleep. God said to Avram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. That's the Egyptian enslavement, that Egyptian slavery that he's talking about there. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. And of course you remember that the 10 plagues judged Egypt, and finally Pharaoh let Israel go. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. You're going to die, Abraham, like all flesh. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. So in verses 12 through 16, the future experience of Abraham's descendants is explained. They will be enslaved for a period of 400 years in a different land, in the land of Egypt. However, after that time of slavery, God will release them from slavery and enrich them and punish the nation that enslaved them. Then they will return to the land of promise when God's judgment is about to fall on the Amorites. Now, Amorite is a generic term for the Canaanites. So he's talking about here the Canaanite tribes in general, all of them in general. All right, let's pick it up on verse 17. And it came about when the sun had set, that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch, which passed between these pieces. Now, in keeping with the way covenants were signed back then, the pieces of the animal were lined up in rows, and so far everything is normal. Everything is as expected, and now the change has come. Now, if both God and Abraham walked through the pieces of the animals, the covenant would be binding on both. So if Abraham broke it, that would release God from keeping the terms of the promise. But Abraham can't walk through the pieces. He's asleep over there on the side in this prophetic or a dream sleep of some sort. He's not doing anything. Therefore, God himself in the form of the Shekhinah walks between the pieces of the animals. So God in the form of the torch, the Shekhinah, the visible manifestation of God in the form of a torch would prefigure the pillar of fire that would guide Israel at night after they left the land of Egypt. And the smoking pot would prefigure the pillar of cloud that would guide the nation by day after they come out of the land of Egypt. And this means that the covenant is binding upon God alone. By the way, the Shekhinah is the visible manifestation of God's presence. God is present everywhere, but he can manifest his omnipresence in specific locations if he desires to do so. And when that happens, that visible manifestation is called the Shekhinah. For example, if God wanted to manifest himself in this location right here, what we would probably see would be a ball of fire or a cloud or something like that. Now, the Shekinah glory, the Shekinah manifests, God manifests his presence in various different forms. It can be a fire, it can be a cloudy pillar, it can be a burning bush, and in the case of Yeshua, it's a human body. So that's what's happening here. God is manifesting his omnipresence by coming, by walking through the pieces of the animals, confirming, signing the covenant with Abraham, first of all in the form of a burning torch, and then in the form of the smoking pot. Now, what does this mean? This means that the covenant is binding upon God alone. Binding upon God alone, regardless of what Abraham or Abraham's descendants may do. Abraham did not walk through the pieces. He did not obligate himself in any way to the covenant. Therefore, this covenant is unconditional. No conditions lie upon Abraham regarding its fulfillment. It is also unilateral, one-sided. God alone is responsible to fulfill this covenant. God has made certain commitments to Abraham and Abraham's descendants, regardless of what Abraham or Abraham's descendants themselves do. Regardless as to whether they remain faithful or not, the promise will be kept, no matter what. God will glorify himself because God always keeps his promises. So, in chapter 15, the covenant is sealed. Now, we're on page 16. Let's move to verse 18. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, the Euphrates River is the northern border, and the river of Egypt is the southern border. Now, if we compare other sections of Scripture that describe the boundaries of the Promised Land, this is the information that we'll gather. Basically, God gives Abraham the western arm of the Fertile Crescent. Now, here is the area from satellite view, and the River of Egypt being the southern border. Some think it is the area where the Suez Canal is located today, but that really doesn't work. That's another study. Others think it is the western arm of the Nile Delta, but that doesn't work either. Again, that's the subject of a different study. The River of Egypt is best understood to be the Wadi al-Arish, a wadi that exits into the Mediterranean Sea right about here. So from the Wadi al-Arish all the way north to the Euphrates River is the boundaries. The Euphrates River is the northern boundary. And so after studying a number of sections of Scripture, this is the conclusion I have come to regarding the boundaries of the land. And again, that's a different study. So the basic idea is that God has given the Jewish people the entire western arm of the Fertile Crescent. That's the idea. Therefore, why have we gone through all this material? We've gone through this material because the Abrahamic covenant supports Zionism. Why? Because Abraham and his descendants are unconditionally promised the homeland. This is long before any Muslims arrived on the scene. The year is approximately 2166 BC when the covenant is confirmed. Genesis chapter 15, it takes place in approximately 2166 BC, and some 2,800 years later is when the Muslims would sweep out of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula and dominate the area, some 2,800 years later. And there's very few Arabs living in the land at this point in time. Very few Arabs living in the land. The people living in the land when the Abrahamic covenant is ratified are listed in Genesis 15. They're listed there. The Kenite and the Kesanite and the Kadmonite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite. Now, all these people groups have disappeared from history. And note, none of these people groups living in the land promised to the Jewish people are Arabs. They are not Arabs. They are Canaanite tribes. They are not Arab tribes. All right, well, let's move on to Deuteronomy 28 and the land covenant. We're on page 18 of your outline. So the next covenant that biblically supports Zionism is the Palestinian, or as I prefer to call it, the land covenant. Now, where did it get the name Palestine or the Palestinian covenant? Well, that came from the Romans. If you go to Wikipedia, you'll get an accurate article on Palestine. The term was first used to denote an official province of the Roman Empire in 135 CE or AD, an official province of the Roman Empire, when the Roman authorities under Hadrian, following the suppression of the Bar Kokhba revolt, that's the second Jewish revolt, combined Judea province and Galilee with other surrounding cities such as Ashkelon to form Syria-Palestinia, the province of Syria-Palestinia. Syria, land of the Philistines is what that means. Land of the Philistines. Which some scholars state was in order to complete the disassociation with Judea. It's not land of the Jews or land of Israel. It's the land of the Palestine or the Philistines. Land of the Philistines is what the Romans named this area. And here's a map. This is Syria-Palestine in the Roman Empire, approximately 200 BC to 350 AD. And you can see Palestinia there. Here it is. This is the boundaries of this province. It includes the Sinai Peninsula. It includes a little bit of what we call Saudi Arabia today, a little bit of what we call Jordan today, the cities of Gaza, Joppa, Caesarea, Samaria, Ashkelon. So this is the province of Syria-Palestinia as developed by the Romans. Hadrian attempted to root out Judaism, which he saw as the cause of continuous rebellions. He prohibited the Torah law and the Hebrew calendar and executed Judaic scholars. The sacred scroll was ceremonially burned on the Temple Mount. At the former temple sanctuary, he installed two statues, one of Jupiter and one very humbly of himself. In an attempt to erase any memory of Judea or ancient Israel, he wiped the name off the map and replaced it with Syria-Palestinia. Syria, land of the Philistines. No more land of the Jews, land of the Philistines. By destroying association of the Jews to Judea and forbidding the practice of Jewish faith, Hadrian aimed to root out the nation that had engaged heavy casualties on the empire. Similarly, he reestablished Jerusalem, but now as the Roman pagan city, the Roman pagan polis of Aelia Capitolina, and Jews were forbidden from entering it except on the day of Tisha B'Av, the great day of mourning for the Jewish people over the destruction of Jerusalem. Rather cruel on the part of the Romans. All right, so that's how the area that we call Israel received the name Palestine. It received it from the Romans. All right, now we're running out of time, so let's just close with a little bit of an overview. The three basic provisions of the Abrahamic covenant are expanded and developed by three other covenants in Scripture, and this chart is on page 24. So we have three other unconditional and eternal covenants made with the Jewish people that expand the Abrahamic covenant. The spiritual blessing promise is expanded and developed by the new covenant of Jeremiah 31 and Ezekiel 36. The national promise is expanded and developed by the Davidic covenant of 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles, Psalm 89, and other sections of Scripture. And the land blessings of the Abrahamic covenant are expanded and developed by the land covenant of Deuteronomy 29 and 30. So the land covenant is found in those two chapters of Deuteronomy. The emphasis of this covenant is on the land of Israel itself. And so the land covenant will develop the land blessings to a further degree. Now, before I go any further, I believe it's essential that we know something about the provisions for disobedience found in the covenants. Even though a covenant is unilateral and unconditional and eternal in nature, that does not exempt the recipients from covenant responsibility. If the recipient of an unconditional eternal covenant is disobedience, they will suffer discipline. The covenant remains in effect and will be fulfilled by God, even though the covenant partner is disciplined. This is a unilateral covenant. Only one partner can annul the covenant, and that is God Himself. But the other partner in the covenant can be disciplined for disobedience to the covenant. So I want to discuss the disciplines associated with the Abrahamic covenant. And that's on page 18 of your outline, the discipline for disobedience. However, we have less than a minute remaining in our session at this time. So we'll pick up the disciplines for disobedience in the Abrahamic covenant in our next session. So thanks so much for being our students. I hope this study in Zionism and the history of Israel will greatly bless your life as we move through all this material. So we'll see you next session. Lehi Tra'ot. Lehi Tra'ot.